This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. This year we traveled across the state hosting forums, hearing from voters, and we heard plenty.
Why do you suppose, with the state of Illinois in such an obvious severe financial crisis, our voters continue to re-elect people who go down to Springfield and get nothing done?
We'll listen back to some of what took place at our events. That's coming up. Also, an attorney and author talks about several cases of a rare childhood cancer that showed up in central Illinois and what was causing it. It's been a year since the Me Too movement caught fire. It put Illinois state government under scrutiny.
We found in our own policy books that we didn't have a prohibition on sexual harassment, you know, on the policy book that we give to our staff.
We'll learn what's happened in the past year and what still needs to be done. All that and more ahead on Statewide. Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, it's been a year since the Me Too movement went viral. We'll look at what has changed in Illinois since then and what remains to be done. Also, an author tells us about an Illinois town where coal tar contamination resulted in a health crisis. And as farmers age, a concern is who's going to take over the land once they're gone. We'll have a report. That and more today on Statewide. We're closing in on Election Day. A lot of us take voting for granted. But Rich Egger brings us the story of a Macomb woman who recently became a U.S. citizen. He follows along as she casts her ballot for the first time.
Julia Albarracin says she came to the U.S. in 1999 to attend graduate school at the University of Florida. She now teaches political science at Western Illinois University, and she was sworn in as an American citizen just a few months ago. Most early voting in McDonough County is done at the courthouse. We walk there from Julia's home, which is just a few blocks away from Macomb's Courthouse Square.
Ready for this. What do I need to bring?
Yourself.
Myself? No ID, nothing. That's sweet.
Are you nervous?
I am excited more than nervous. Maybe both. A little bit of both, yeah.
You grew up in La Plata, Argentina?
Yeah, I was born in La Plata, Argentina. I grew up part of the time there, more in a suburb, on the way to Buenos Aires. And then my dad, who was working in Buenos Aires most of his life, decided that we should move to Buenos Aires itself. So I was there growing up. It was a very different experience. In Argentina, voting is mandatory. It's not an option. And so people take it very seriously. And you have no choice. You have to vote. In theory, you could even go to prison if you don't vote. In reality, that never happens. But it's a very formal process. You have an ID where they stamp your passport. It's like a little passport, but it's a national ID. When you go to the polls, they stamp it to make sure that you have a proof that you voted. And I voted there all my life. I was pretty active in politics. I always loved politics. So I stayed in tune here in the U.S. too, and finally now I can vote.
How do you feel about that idea that voting is mandatory?
Well, I have mixed feelings about it. I think it makes sense for people to take it as an obligation, their sense of civic duty, and just do it.
Why did you decide to become an American citizen? Did you want to vote, or were there reasons beyond that?
I think if you're going to live in a different country, you might as well enjoy all the benefits and also the responsibilities that come with that. And I much rather be an active participant in this democracy other than just like live here and watch other people make decisions for me.
All right. We're at the courthouse now. We're outside the courthouse. The voting place, early voting place, is in the basement of the courthouse. And we are ready to enter.
Oh, yeah. No.
Hi.
Hello.
And they're really interrupting us.
You need to vote?
Last name?
It's A.L.
Julia gives some basic information to staff members who check their database to make sure she's registered. After that, Julia receives some final instructions.
Over on the machines.
Okay.
Up in the upper right-hand corner, little green light. Push the card clear until it clicks. Follow the prompts on screen. It's all touch. If you vote for somebody you don't want to, touch it again. It goes away. You can recast that vote on that ballot. Okay?
And do I get a printout of what I vote for?
No, the printout is our copy.
Oh, okay.
So if something were to happen to the electronics, that we will have something to count by hand.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
And with that, Julia walks over to one of the voting machines to begin exercising her right to vote as an American citizen. Once she's gone through the ballot and cast all her votes, the machine digests the information, and she's done.
You want this back?
Yes, please.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Julia is a member of the League of Women Voters and says the local candidates forum helped her learn more about those running for office. She says information on the web also made her a more informed voter. We walked out of the courthouse and toured Sullivan Taylor Coffee House on the southeast corner of the square.
So it's done?
It's done. I'm done. Yes, I should celebrate now. Let's get some coffee.
So what are your thoughts now that you've been through this once?
I think it's pretty easy. Everybody should do it. I don't think I would go all the way to make it mandatory in this country, but it's really appalling sometimes to see how many people waste this opportunity to have a say in government.
Voter turnout nationally for the 2014 midterm elections was just 36.4%, and it was just 41% for the 2010 midterms. Rich Egger reporting.
We heard from a lot of voters this year as we conducted a series of forums around the state, and I was the moderator for all 11 of them. We heard from people in Chicago, Carbondale, and points in between. We heard some good things that are going on in communities, but it also became evident people are unhappy with the direction the state is heading. I heard a similar question over and over. We'll let Chris Bowers from our Naperville event weigh in.
Why do you suppose, with the state of Illinois in such an obvious severe financial crisis, our voters continue to reelect people who get down to Springfield and get nothing done?
Much of the finger-pointing for Illinois' situation was directed at those who hold office, Democrats and Republicans. Illinois is a diverse state with a lot of advantages, but with state government coming off a long budget impasse that saw its backlog of unpaid bills skyrocket, as well as the chronic underfunding of public employee pensions, many of the people appear to have lost faith in a turnaround. A recent University of Illinois Springfield NPR Illinois survey backed up that observation. It found 3 out of 4 people in Illinois see the state on the wrong track. But former Governor Jim Edgar, who joined our first panel in Springfield, did offer some hope.
I have to say it's better now than it was a year ago. Now, it's still terrible, but it's better.
Edgar was referring to the reinstatement of a higher income tax rate and approval of a budget ending that impasse.
People were really upset because they were hurting. Not having a budget for 2 years was the worst thing I have ever seen in my 50 years. I thought it was worse than the Begorovich year by far.
Throughout Illinois, there's also a growing worry about loss of population, especially as many young people find more opportunity elsewhere. Outside of the Chicago area, we heard from many residents who say there's no reason for younger people to settle down there, even in towns where they were born and raised. Illinois lost more people in 2016 than any other state. Candace Larson from Alton says she knows where to lay the blame.
I think it all stems from career politicians. They're more interested in keeping their jobs and their power intact rather than solving problems.
But professor of political science Stephen Maynard Caliendo with North Central College says the reasons are likely more complex, but he admits leadership does play a role.
It's not that I love my job, I love my neighborhood, I love my school, but man, Madigan's really making me mad, so I'm going to move to Wisconsin. It typically doesn't work that way, right? But if because there's dysfunction in the state and then it resulted in budget crises, which make the environment more difficult to operate or that the schools become less strong or there's concerns about those, other places look more attractive.
Other voices we heard mentioned the state has a reputation as being bad for business. Taxes, regulations, workers' compensation costs, they said, are driving employers and jobs elsewhere. Bill Bloom is from Rock Island.
You know, when you look at the cost of doing business in Illinois, it's materially higher than it is in some of the surrounding states. What do we need to do to attract businesses to Illinois?
Well, for one, better training of the workforce. That was the topic in Rockford, where we heard about collaborations among higher education and companies. In Galesburg, a town with a proud history of manufacturing, the closure of a large Maytag plant in 2004 is still being felt. Many other communities are in the same situation, lamenting the loss of what were good-paying jobs. But Galesburg is moving on. Ken Springer is president of the Knox County Area Partnership for Economic Development.
I think it's just important that we keep our eyes down the road and not try to recreate a past that may not be compatible with where the current economy is and what our community's assets are. I mean, it's important to celebrate history, but I think we always have to be looking forward.
Throughout our visits, we got an earful, especially about what many feel the state is doing wrong. Jennifer Olson is president and CEO of the Carbondale Chamber of Commerce and says that doesn't tell everything.
I think sometimes we're just our own worst enemy because all we want to do is tell the negative stories. And we need to be talking about the businesses that have had success here and what was their secret.
Holding these events in an election year was no accident. We listened to what was on the minds of voters. We heard the good and the bad. We'll have to wait to see if politicians were paying attention. I'm Sean Crawford. Illinoisans will vote for their representatives in Congress and the State House this election. They'll also choose scores of judges, the ones who rule on everything from traffic tickets to medical malpractice. Illinois' largest association of lawyers recently published its ratings for judicial candidates, as Mary Hansen has details.
Long before Election Day, members of the Illinois State Bar Association filled out another ballot, grading their colleagues running for circuit court judge. They evaluate temperament, integrity, and fairness. The goal is to provide insight on candidates for an office people usually don't know much about. Claire Manning, a Springfield-based attorney, says lawyers are supposed to only fill out the questionnaire for candidates they know. They consider things like
the person's approach to the public, his or her reputation as a lawyer, and his or her just kind of personality and ability to be balanced and ability to be just.
Manning chairs the Bar Association's committee that evaluates judicial candidates. She says voters should take into account the number of years a candidate has practiced law or been an associate judge, and their community service. To find the ratings, you can go to the association's website, isba.org. I'm Mary Hansen.
Still to come on today's program, we look back a year after the Me Too movement took off, with a focus on what has happened in Illinois since then. And how a change in law is impacting healthcare workers when it comes to flu shots, that and much more, still ahead on Statewide. The average age of American farmers is nearly 60 and trending older. If they don't plan for what happens with their land after they die, they won't have a say. Even so, passing property on is harder than it sounds. Madeline Beck tells us more about farmland transfer.
The Curry family farm is a little world of its own. Creeks and ponds and rolling hills in the middle of a pretty flat central Illinois. Each night, it's hog feeding time. Kim Curry said the property has been in the family since 1886, but she only moved there in 2008 when her father was dying of cancer. Now she says she can't keep up with it all.
We just don't have the energy to deal with the fencing.
Curry works for the state, comes home to her sister and niece, and they tend to the animals, which include hogs, chickens, cows, and 7 dogs. She maybe eats dinner by 8. She wants to sell about 80 acres of hilly grazing property, so she posted it this summer on a regional ag organization's website.
It really has potential with someone younger, more energy.
But Curry hasn't had any takers. She used that site because it was free and was the only place she knew about.
I didn't know to look.
There are other places in Illinois where you can advertise property for sale, like online and newspaper classifieds, but no large-scale state-run program like what's next door in Iowa. It's called AgLink, a database meant to link new farmers wanting to rent or buy land with tenured farmers wanting to provide those kinds of opportunities. And it's run by Iowa State University's Extension and Outreach. In a state where nearly a third of Iowa farmland owners are older than 75, David Baker with AgLink says he has requests from way more beginning farmers than older farmers.
I would say 11 to 1, 12 to 1. I need more of the farm families to say, we have a legitimate business and we'd like to see it go on into the future. We'd like to support our communities by having this business here.
About 20 states have something similar to AgLink, some public, some private, and at least in Iowa, could use more interest from the older generation because fewer kids are staying on the farm. And if there isn't someone to pass the farm on to, it could become part of a larger operation, taking away opportunities for new farmers. Sally Worley is with Practical Farmers of Iowa, a group that promotes farm sustainability and healthy environments. She calls a major land transfer imminent.
The biological clock is ticking for a lot of those farmland owners.
And she's concerned about what that could mean for farm communities if farmland consolidation continues. Things like fewer people and slower economies. But she acknowledges it's hard to even think about retiring from farming.
You get so passionate about what you do that it's hard to pull back the reins and let somebody else lead.
And part of the problem is that people have to face death. Mervyn Roth encourages farmers not to wait for the inevitable. He's a farm manager in Macomb, Illinois, who helps keep a farm operation running when farmers die and pass on property to kids who don't farm. He says a plan can ensure a farm keeps running a certain way after death. Poor planning, on the other hand, can lead to arguments.
One family member wants to do one thing, one family member wants to do another, and so they call us in as a referee.
But the farmers who hold on until they die have an incentive to do so. Their property doesn't get taxed when they pass it down to their children, but those kids may already be in their 50s and 60s. Meanwhile, there are young farmers and beginning farmers watching and waiting for someone to give them an opportunity. Madeline Beck, Harvest Public Media.
Stay with us on Statewide. Madeline has more on this topic coming up in just a moment. We're back on Statewide. Still to come, we talk with the author of a new book who says pollution led to an outbreak of a rare childhood cancer in one central Illinois community, Taylorville. And now we continue with Madeline Beck's reporting on farmland transfer. She explains the average age of farmers keeps going up. There are concerns about what will happen to their land once they've passed away.
Beginning farmers aren't a monolith, but they generally fall into one of two categories. Those who want to start small, local, and organic operations, or those who want to stay in the family business and grow conventional crops like corn and soybeans, like John Heaton. He's 26 and sells corn and soybean seed outside Toulon, Illinois. He invited me into his warehouse slash office. But what he really wants to do is farm his own land.
You know, growing up on a family farm is what I grew up with, it's what I love.
Just as his father and grandfather did, Heaton is looking for land to rent from retiring farmers. But farmers are hanging on longer, and farms continue to be consolidated, so there are fewer opportunities. One angle Heaton has tried is a database in Iowa called AgLink that connects tenured farmers with beginning ones, potentially to buy or rent land. David Baker runs AgLink, and he encourages beginning farmers to think of renting first.
Land is by far the last thing I want to see them try and take on and saddle themselves with debt for land, because that's the slowest return on their investment.
Baker's database is part of the Beginning Farmer Program at Iowa State Extension and Outreach, and is a little like a dating service. It starts online, but the real connection has to happen in person.
And through several, you know, conversations, because I think communication is the key to this, is that they either decide, no, this probably isn't what I'm really interested in, or they say, I'm still very interested in what you have. I'd like to come and visit you.
There are farmer networks to do this through, too. Large organized groups or a few guys who regularly meet for coffee. But the next step in starting a farm is nailing down the business side of things.
When people come to our program, they tend to be pretty starry-eyed and a little romantic about the notion of farming. And so we do our best to take those rose-colored glasses off.
That's Sherry Doyle with the Angelic Organics Learning Center in Northern Illinois. Her organization runs a course that brings tenured farmers together with new farmers to go over business details, including land acquisition. She says it throws an extra wrench into a farmer's budget.
So when you add on a mortgage to the numbers that you're running, it's quite difficult to make a profit.
That's part of why Doyle stands behind renting first. But for those who are dead set on buying a small local operation, it's also hard to find 10 to 15 acre pieces of farmable land for sale. Large 100 acre properties are hard to break up, and the smaller parcels are attractive to a lot of non-farmers, like retirees and horse owners. Ben Snare and his family faced that challenge and searched for the perfect place for more than a year. They found it outside Beloit, Wisconsin. But even then, there was an issue.
Zoning. It was a big thing that I never really thought of, but it ended up being a really big thing where we weren't even going to be able to put up a greenhouse.
Snare successfully got that changed, but it's notoriously hard to maintain a steady profit with a small farm. So they're pivoting toward more meat production and live events, which gives them a more reliable income, and a farm job when they get too old for heavy manual labor. After he mentions that, Snare chases down a cow in the yard. His four-year-old daughter, Emma, fills the space.
I just learned a couple letters. O.
Oh.
I learned it today. And then Z, but no B.
Emma is already helping the Snares transplant onions, and Ben loves watching his baby, Hayden, around the chickens. There's even a third possible farmer on the way. Madeline Beck, Harvest Public Media.
Next up on Statewide, in the late 1980s, coal tar dust left behind by an abandoned gas plant was exposed in the central Illinois town of Taylorville. Several children were soon diagnosed with what's known as neuroblastoma, a rare form of childhood cancer. Bill Clutter is a private investigator from Springfield and helped a group of mothers take the cases to court. He talked with our reporter Daisy Contreras about the new book, Coal Tar, where he tells the story of how politics and corporate greed led to the outbreak.
Now, as the prologue in the book explains, this is a true story about two small cities, Taylorville,
That's right.
Illinois, and Morgan City, Louisiana, whose air, water, and soil were polluted with coal tar. Now, coal tar is one of the most toxic carcinogens that we know of, and we get it as a byproduct from the gasification of coal. This led to what you call in your book an epidemic of rare childhood cancer, neuroblastoma,
right,
that plagued both communities in the late 1980s. Walk me through the timeline of events here. So we have this company based out of Taylorville in the 1800s that does what? And then what ended up happening?
The facility was Taylorville Gas Works. It manufactured gas out of coal. The byproduct, of course, was coal tar. Many communities across the country had these facilities. There's as many as 2,500 around the country today. And some are still being cleaned up. But in the early 1900s, Central Illinois Public Service Company formed. They produced electricity to power trolleys in the beginning. And eventually they started getting into the gas business. They started acquiring these small companies that were town-based. I mean, each town owned their own facility, basically. You know, there was companies that formed. Taylorville, Shelbyville, DuQuoin. Quincy, Canton, Illinois. Springfield had two. So CIPS decommissioned these in the early 1930s as natural gas was discovered in Texas around 1901, as pipelines were constructed crossing the Mississippi. They came to this area in around 1932. So when that happened, there was a less expensive supply of gas. It was cleaner because it was natural. And these facilities were decommissioned. Most of them had coal tar remaining in underground tanks that were just left there.
What is neuroblastoma and why does it impact children? And I'm sure you looked very deeply into this.
Oh. Yeah, a neuroblastoma, it's a rare childhood cancer. It has an incident rate of 1 in 100,000 live births. And it's a cancer that attacks the nerve cells, and primarily it's often found near the adrenal gland in the abdomen. And the chance of survival is best if it's obviously caught early. With infants, their chance of survival is much greater than those of older children. And in our case, in Taylorville, we had three infants that were diagnosed within a year in 1990. And it followed the exposure, a sudden release, an acute exposure of coal tar dust that was churned up through excavation of bulldozers and backhoes and trucks trucking it off. And that happened in 1987. But in our case, by the time we went to trial, it was a major civil case that went to trial in 1997. It was a six-month jury trial that found in favor of our plaintiffs. We represented at the time four children that had neuroblastoma. By the time we went to trial, there had been a total of seven cases in Christian County from 1988 until 1996.
Have you talked to any of those families now, followed up, and see where they're at?
I have.
What?
In fact,
what are the updates?
Their stories are in the book. Well, Erica May was the lead plaintiff when the case first got filed. She is living in Taylorville. She was an infant when her tumor was discovered. I mean, she still bears the scars from the surgery. Outwardly, you wouldn't know that she was a cancer survivor. But I mean, one of her concerns now as a young woman is whether she's going to be able to have children of her own. Because of the chemotherapy, there's a concern that she may not be able to bear children.
I'm Daisy Contreras, and I'm talking to Bill Clutter about his new book, Coal Tar, How Corrupt Politics and Corporate Greed Are Killing America's Children. Bill, you say that you recently uncovered or came across similar stories happening out of Indiana.
Right.
What is happening in Indiana, and can they learn from what happened here in Illinois?
Well, going back to Taylorville, there was a very active group of parents. Brenda May, whose daughter Erica was diagnosed with neuroblastoma, formed the Taylorville Awareness Group. In Franklin, Indiana, there's another group being formed in that community. It's south of Indianapolis, about 30, 35 miles. And their organization is called If It Was Your Child. And they've had, since 2010, up to 50 childhood cancers in that county, Johnson County. And they're beginning to investigate. And there's several sites. There's a RECRA facility. And when I use the word RECRA, that is the Resource and Conservation Recovery Act that was passed in 1976, and it was to manage the transportation, disposal, and incineration of hazardous waste from operating facilities. There's an operating facility that had been contaminating groundwater for many years. So they've been focused in on that, but someone on their website, Facebook site posted about Duke Energy having so-called cleaned up a manufactured gas plant that's not right next to a park, a large public park, also next to a stream. And they went in, just like CIPS did. They were going to use foam spray to control dust emissions. And this was recent. This was 2012. And they had a major flood in 2008 that would have raised the groundwater above the surface, exposing that community to coal tar. And they also have a second site. So this is a community that had two coal gasification facilities. Taylorville had just one. And so in our case, the Illinois EPA had asked CIPS to consider building a containment dome to treat the vapors, to control the dust. And CIPS said that they were considering a cheaper alternative, spray foam. And when we got into the lawsuit, the engineer, the air pollution control engineer that designed their air monitoring plan, was predicting they would create excess cancers if they didn't undertake more heroic engineering controls. And that was presented at trial. And I think that's why we prevailed in getting a verdict against CIPS. in March of 1998.
What impact do you want your book to have on the future of these communities?
I want people to get involved in their democracy. I want people to understand what's happening in their communities. And, you know, I'd like them to do something about it, because there is strength in numbers. We do, as people, have power.
Bill, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
That's the author and investigator Bill Clutter talking about his new book, Coal Tar. You can find out more about it at our website. Go to statewideshow.com. Well, October marks the start of flu season in the U.S. More than half of all states, including Illinois, have laws regarding flu shots for healthcare workers. And a new change to Illinois' law should make it harder for employees to decline the vaccine. But some on the front lines of public health worry the law has no teeth. Christine Herman explains.
The new Illinois statute essentially requires all healthcare workers at hospitals and long-term care facilities to get the flu shot. Employers have to offer the vaccine to employees, and employees have to take it unless they've already gotten the flu shot elsewhere or
unless they have a religious objection or if they have some sort of medical problem that would be complicated by getting the vaccine.
That's one of the law's lead sponsors, Democratic State Senator Bill Cunningham of Chicago. He says the old law wasn't clear on what kinds of exemptions were allowed.
They basically allowed for employees of hospitals to use just their personal convictions as a legitimate reason to deny an influenza vaccine.
That, he says, created conflicts between the hospitals that wanted everyone vaccinated and employees who didn't want to get the flu shot. The new law allows healthcare facilities to take disciplinary action against anyone who declines the vaccine without a medical or religious exemption. Cunningham says that could mean a suspension or even getting fired.
I don't think any hospital wants to get to that point, and I think that they feel like having the law clarified will help them avoid those kind of conflicts.
Dr. Nirav Shah directs Illinois' Department of Public Health. His agency licenses the more than 3,000 health facilities affected by these new rules. He says these stricter flu shot requirements are important in light of last year's particularly deadly flu season. It claimed an estimated 80,000 lives across the U.S. That's according to the director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in an interview with the Associated Press. And the flu shot hospitalized 900,000 more.
Healthcare workers are at ground zero. They are often coming into contact with other individuals who might have the flu and then could potentially transmit it to another patient.
The goal, Shah says, is to stop that. But some on the front lines of public health worry the law won't do that. That's because it doesn't require anyone to track whether healthcare facilities are doing what's now required of them. Julie Pride leads the Champaign-Urbana Public Health Department.
If there's no follow-up, look at something as simple as a speed limit sign. If you know that there's nobody checking up on you, people aren't going to follow it.
Shah says his agency will conduct regular facilities inspections, and checking up on flu shot programs could be a part of that. But Pride says the law would be more effective if it allowed public health officials at the state level to work with local departments like hers to do more thorough enforcement. Danny Chun is a spokesman for the Illinois Health and Hospital Association. He points out that flu shot rates for hospital workers are already pretty high nationwide, 92%, according to the CDC.
Hospitals and healthcare workers are very aware of the risks and dangers of the influenza season.
But for employees at long-term care facilities like nursing homes, the nationwide flu shot rate is much lower, at 67%. That's why Pride says it's so important to make sure the facilities are in fact requiring flu shots.
If people see this law in the news, they're going to assume that their loved ones are being protected, when in fact, it may not be.
Shah says his agency has already done what the law requires, write the new rules and notify facilities about them.
So the implementation and execution of this program is really left now to the facilities.
State Senator Cunningham says he doesn't anticipate compliance will be an issue, but if it is, he's open to amending the law further. But Pride's question remains, if no one's checking, how will people really know healthcare workers are getting the flu shot? I'm Christine Herman, Side Effects Public Media.
Stick around. There's more of Statewide just ahead. We're back on Statewide. Coming up, we'll take a look at the Me Too movement in Illinois. A year after that movement went viral, Rachel Otwell's been talking with some state leaders about it. That's just ahead. But now let's slow down, relax, and travel to a yoga class. This one is on a farm in southern Illinois. And did I mention it also involves a herd of goats? Shayla Farzan has the story.
20 people lay side by side in a shady fenced-in pen, stretching their legs to the sky. Yoga instructor Alicia Davis sits at the front of the class and tries to demonstrate one of the poses.
We're going to do side body stretches on this side, getting those obliques nice and... Hi, Shirley.
Shirley, an 80-pound Alpine Swiss milking goat, is more interested in the grass than the yoga poses. She parks herself directly in front of Davis for a quick snack.
I hope no one needs to see me demoing this, because Shirley is demoing how to be a very pretty goat right now.
Alicia and Josh Davis run Green-Finned Hippie Farm in Pocahontas, Illinois, about 40 miles northeast of St. Louis. They started goat yoga classes in the spring of 2017 as a way to socialize the goats and make them easier to work with. Since then, the classes have become surprisingly popular, with some selling out weeks in advance. Megan Conover lives in Imperial, Missouri. This is her first time doing goat yoga, and she wasn't disappointed.
I am a goat fanatic, so I actually want to have goats of my own, and I'm having goats in my wedding. They are bringing the rings down the aisle, so there are goat bearers.
The goats don't always behave. Sometimes they start nibbling on the yoga mats or headbutting each other. One goat even rifled around in a participant's purse while her back was turned. But for St. Louis resident Erica Sparks, that's all part of the fun.
It's very interactive. The goats are not shy. I actually got stepped on while I was in like a hands and knees posture, and it didn't hurt at all. It was just a little bit of pressure on my finger.
The goat yoga classes will continue through the end of the month. I'm Shayla Farzan.
Daisy Contreras, and you're listening to Statewide. This month marks a year since the Me Too movement went viral. It has certainly played out in Illinois, with allegations against some in state government leading to firings. We've seen several policy changes, like adding language barring sexual harassment, to filling the vacant seat of the legislative inspector general, who was meant to investigate allegations of sexual harassment and misconduct. That seat, we found out, had been left empty for 2 years. Rachel, you went into this series asking people what had changed and if they thought the movement still had potential. What did you learn?
Yeah, so we talked a lot about what was going on within state government, was the focus of most of these conversations. And like you mentioned, come to find out that people within the state house, within the legislature, weren't getting trained on sexual harassment procedures. So that language was added to policy manuals, and trainings are now supposed to be happening on a regular basis. And then also there have been some high-profile cases, like you mentioned. There were allegations from a campaign worker, Elena Hampton, that led to the firing of an aide to House Speaker Michael Madigan. His name was Kevin Quinn. And that was a case where there were text messages released following an in-depth interview Hampton did with the Tribune. So the public had an inside look at some of these pretty disturbing claims. And then months later, Madigan's longtime chief of staff was fired, Tim Mapes, after a claim surfaced of his harassing and bullying behavior. So I didn't really focus on those cases so much as what has gone on in a policy sense And as far as the research and the sort of information gathering phase that has been going on, I spoke, for instance, with Comptroller Susana Mendoza about a panel she co-chairs with two female members of the state's General Assembly. And they looked specifically into conditions for campaign workers doing listening sessions around the state with hundreds of women and say there need to be better guidelines, more accountability, and that it's especially bad for campaign workers, or it's especially a gray area anyway for campaign workers because of the fact that a lot of times their work is very temporary. There's not as much a structure in place as far as who these people can report to if something were to happen. And then a big focus of what Mendoza had to say had to do with the push for gender parity within state government. Her and the panel argue if it was more closer to 50-50%, 50% women, or even more, we would be closer to having some sort of environment where these things were brought to light, where there was more transparency as well as accountability and repercussions. And so here's some of what she had to say.
There is no state in the country that has ever had a female majority legislature, both House and Senate together. And Illinois is relatively close. I mean, 35% may sound like a long way away from 50, but when you put it into perspective, how we even got to 35%, and I think this is the key. Look at the three people on the panel, Melinda Bush, myself, and Carol Ammons. All three of us got to the legislature by running against the party's preferred candidate.
She goes on to say, considering that she and others were able to be successful running against the party's preferred candidates, if there was actually a concerted effort with the backing of the parties and the money that brings along with it, she thinks this is an achievable goal.
So that was State Comptroller Susana Mendoza, a Chicago Democrat, who says she wants to push for gender parity within state government as a means to curtail harassment in government and within political parties and campaigns. Rachel, you also heard from State Representative Sarah Wojcicki Jimenez of Leland Grove, which is in the Springfield area. She's the Republican spokesperson for the House Sexual Discrimination and Harassment Task Force. She makes an interesting point. We've talked about how there have been some legislative initiatives to push back against sexual harassment, but Wojcicki Jimenez says solutions should also come in the form of cultural changes.
Right. So she says something that you hear a lot in the discussions about the Me Too movement, that policies can change, the state legislature can train its members on sexual harassment, what that means and what should be acceptable. But at the end of the day, the onus is really on us as people living out in public, going to school, going to work, to create a culture where it's no longer normalized behavior to be sexist toward women or, of course, to be harassing, etc. And so I'll go ahead and share a little bit of what she had to say about that.
There's a couple of paths that people are on, the legislative reform type path. And then there's another path that's more societal, cultural, behavioral, that is going to take a while because you can't legislate that. Most big shifts have changed, not when the group that's being discriminated against overcomes. It's when the rest of the people come together and say, you know what, we're not going to do that anymore.
And so both she and Barbara Flynn Curry, who has been in the legislature for decades and is a Democrat in the House, a member of leadership, both of them are leaving at the end of their term. The report that will be out in December from that task force will be some of the last work they do.
I'm Daisy Contreras. You are listening to Statewide. I'm joined by Rachel Otwell. We are talking about the one-year anniversary of the Me Too movement. While it was a movement started by Tarana Burke in 2006, it's been a year since it became more viral in the mainstream media. Rachel, your series looks specifically within state government. You also spoke to State Senator Toy Hutchinson of Olympia Fields. Hutchinson is a member of the Senate Sexual Discrimination and Harassment Awareness Task Force. In her time in the Senate, she has led measures meant to better the lives of survivors of human trafficking. What is the connection here?
Right. So Toy Hutchinson is somebody who very much believes in the need to look at issues like sexism through an intersectional lens, meaning, issues like classism, racism, sexism are all connected in various ways. And so if we're talking about sexism, we also need to be talking about racism and the fact that women of color face both of these things in ways that are different than white women face them. And Tarana Burke, who you mentioned, actually started the Me Too movement in 2006. She coined that phrase to talk about the pervasiveness of these issues. Burke is a Black woman, and she is the director now of a New York-based intergenerational nonprofit called Girls for Gender Equity. She has been given credit in many cases for the Me Too movement, although some people still think that it just started as a result of the Harvey Weinstein allegations coming to light. So people like Toy Hutchinson are here to say, actually, like, let's give credit where it's due and let's look at the bigger issues here that are facing people outside of privileged white women. One of those examples is survivors of human trafficking. She sponsored a measure that was signed into law actually earlier this year that would make the process for victims of human trafficking to seal their criminal records an easier one. It, as Hutchinson said, you know, you can't be both a victim and a criminal in this case. And so I asked her, is there room within the Me Too movement to talk about things like human trafficking or human trafficked survivors part of the Me Too movement? And her answer was definitely yes. And so I'll let her speak for herself.
There's so many instances where people think that human trafficking is just an Eastern European problem. Like, it's the quote unquote mail order bride. And they don't realize how pervasive it is in the United States, across major cities, in rural areas. We also very rarely see a face that is a woman of color. And the statistics on that are heartbreaking. There are a number of things as it relates to trauma and African-American women and other women of color, where there is a palpable feeling that our pain and our trauma is not heard.
That was State Senator Toy Hutchinson on the intersection of race and sexual harassment and violence. Rachel, you spoke with State Senator Melinda Bush. She's on the same panel as Mendoza, as well as the Senate task force that Hutchinson is on. What did you speak with her about specifically?
So we talked largely about the legislative inspector general. And so this is the position that is in charge with dealing with claims of sexual harassment, other misconduct. And that seat had been unfilled for some 2 years in the wake of the Me Too movement. Legislators swiftly put somebody into that seat. Melinda Bush helped sponsor a measure meant to kind of rehaul the way that claims are dealt with. There's an ethics commission that the inspector general reports to.
Frankly, we wanted that independence for the inspector general so that if a complaint came forward, the foxes weren't guarding the hen house.
So that's more of what Melinda Bush, State Senator Melinda Bush, had to say. And we linked to more of the kind of in and outs of that policy at the website nprillinois.org.
We've talked about how some women within state government plan to continue fighting for change. But the last person you spoke to, Polly Poskin, weighed on what people outside of state government can do to address issues brought to light through the Me Too movement. Tell us about that.
Right. So Polly Poskin is the director of the Illinois Coalition Against Sexual Assault, and that's a coalition of rape crisis centers throughout the state of Illinois, some of which had to deal with layoffs and some closures as a result of the state's budget impasse, worth noting. But anyway, Polly talked to me about what the average person might be able to do when it comes to dealing with issues of sexual harassment in the workplace specifically. You know, she's really interested in what colleges and universities are doing. And so here is some of what she had to say about how people in general can come together to try to kind of change the culture here that might be behind what enables some of this behavior that's been brought to light through the Me Too movement.
It's a phrase we're, kind of using these days without, again, maybe having the discussion about what does it mean. The culture is the environment in which you work. It's the tone. It's the temper. It's the expectation that is set by the leadership in collaboration with the people who work there. So, you know, hopefully there is some way collectively people sit down and define what constitutes a safe culture for them.
And she went on to say, you know, bosses obviously really have the onus here of as far as the responsibility in addressing this issue and being proactive instead of a reactionary, putting policies in place if they're not there, talking regularly to employees about those policies, talking about what's appropriate behavior. But then employees can come together and go to their bosses, of course, if that is not in place and if they think it should be. So it really is kind of a collective effort that needs to be happening more often here.
Thank you. That's been Rachel Odwell, who covers culture and equity for NPR Illinois. Her series on the Me Too movement and what's happened as a result throughout the past year is at nprillinois.org. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Daisy Contreras.
We're glad you could be with us for Statewide. We'll be back again next week with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. If you missed any part of the show or want to listen again, you can find it at statewideshow.com. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.